And joining us on the book club today is William P. Armstrong, a.k.a. Bill Armstrong. For those of you who may remember, Bill was a reporter at KTSM Television back in the 80s. And then Bill changed careers. He went into the military. He retired as a captain, but he was also in the Gulf War. And he's just written, I shouldn't say he's just written a book, because he's written several books. One of them was about the ghosts of the Gulf War. The other one is Far-Fetched, Who Let the Cats Out? And his latest novel is Uncle Udi's Summer Camp, Making Beds and Bread in the Summer of 77. Bill, thank you so much for being with us.
Louis, thank you very much for inviting me to join you on this great program today.
Now, Bill and I were college roommates at New Mexico State University, but we're going to talk a little bit about, first of all, your background in writing, Bill. Have you always been interested in reading and writing books?
Well, in reading, definitely. And I read a lot of books as a kid. Summer times were really special for us. My mother was a school teacher, so she would read to us at very young ages. And then once we were old enough, we each got our own library card. This is back in central Illinois, a little town called Washington near Peoria. So we would check out books in the summer and just take home a stack of them every couple of weeks and read through those. And, it was just a great start. And then I did a little bit of creative writing with a course I took in junior college. And then just kind of experimented with it after college. In particular, after the Army, I really started to think about writing fiction and read some books about it. And here I am today, just still, I don't consider myself any kind of expert, but I sure enjoy it as a hobby.
Let's talk about, you just mentioned when you were in the Army and you started writing, and then after the Army. What made you change careers from television broadcasting to the Army? That's quite a change.
Well, I had a next-door neighbor in El Paso who had just completed the Army's officer candidate course, officer candidate school at Fort Benning, Georgia. And in those days, I used to enjoy running maybe 3 or 4 miles in the evening to avoid the El Paso heat, but try to stay in shape. It was a great stress release also. And my next-door neighbor, a guy named Jim McDonough, decided that maybe he wanted to go along with me on my route down North Mesa Street and up Kings Hill and some of those other side streets. And so we started running together, and he told me all about the Army and the OCS program and how quickly I could become a commissioned officer like him. And he was taking the air defense course for officers at Fort Bliss at the time. And we stayed in touch. And there, just a couple of years later, I decided I'd had enough of news reporting and wanted to try something like that, something like the Army, just a whole new adventure.
When you were accepted to officer candidate school, I remember, if I remember correctly, one of the letters that you wrote was that it was a little bit tough because you were one of the older candidates.
Yeah, I was. I was 28 at the time. We had many candidates who decided to go through OCS as soon as they got their bachelor's degrees at 22. And a lot of those guys were National Guardsmen who would then go back as lieutenants back to their home states and do it for the guard units there. There were some guys older than me, though. I remember we had a guy who was 33 years old, which was really pushing the deadline there for eligibility. But I think the main thing about going that route was making sure you could run 5 miles and still function afterwards, you know, keep a pretty good clip, a good pace, and get your cardio up. And by golly, you do push-ups, it seemed like, all day long.
One of the things that a lot of the soldiers here, being Fort Bliss, we get a lot of soldiers who we've talked to, neighbors, as you mentioned, friends of the family, and a lot of them have been overseas, been deployed to Afghanistan, been deployed to the Middle East, and some of them say, you know, it's really different from, and obviously it is, when you're training, and then when you step off that plane or helicopter, and you see and hear those bullets.
Yeah, I have to agree. The training was such a different world for us. You're using blank ammunition, and I can tell you, shooting blanks is a lot harder to clean your weapon afterwards. It leaves a lot of powder in the barrel. But you know, when you're out in the real world, out in a combat zone, you're much more aware of not just trying to find out where the enemy is, but where to step. That was one of our big issues, was the hazards that were buried beneath the surface, because back in those days, Saddam Hussein had laid a lot of minefields in preparation for the Allied invasion, basically, the Gulf War, the Desert Storm.
We're visiting with Bill Armstrong. Bill is the author of the book Uncle Ludi's Summer Camp, Making Beds and Bread in the Summer of 77. Now, when you were deployed, did you have time to write in your journal and write ideas? Because as I mentioned, one of the books that you had previously is about the ghosts of the Gulf War.
At that time, I did not. We stayed pretty busy. We got very little sleep. The only real writing I would do was I tried to write letters to my wife every day or every other day. And I also would write stories and take photographs of the 3rd Armored Division as we cut across Iraq from Saudi Arabia. I tried to make sure that I could keep people at home abreast of what we were doing as a unit, you know, the spouses and dependents back in Germany where we were based. And then when I wasn't doing that, I was escorting civilian news media, people from the San Diego Union, the Houston Post, the New York Times, and AP Radio, people like that.
We're visiting with Bill Armstrong. His latest book is Uncle Ludi's Summer Camp, Making Beds and Bread in the Summer of 77. Now, I mentioned at the beginning that you went to New Mexico State. You lived in Garcia Hall. Both of us did. We were roommates. But in the summer of 77, you decided to take a summer job with the Grand Canyon. Of course, this is a fictional camp that you're talking about. But how did that come about? Did the National Park Service go on campus to recruit students? How did that work?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I was thinking about it the other day. We had a student newspaper at NMSU called The Roundup, and there was a classified ad that said, if you're looking for summer work, come to Garcia Annex, where they had a little student employment office, and they had a bulletin board. And you could sign up for an interview with a man named Jerry Lipsky. And Jerry Lipsky was a recruiter for the personnel department of AMFAC. AMFAC was a hotel chain based in Hawaii, but they had a contract at the time to run all of the lodges on the south rim of Grand Canyon. So I went over there and set up for an interview, and turned out Mr. Lipsky became ill on his road trip, had to cancel our interviews, and instead sent us all who had applied packets with applications to fill out for these various hotel jobs, and they were 90-day contracts. And in those days, they told us you had to pay $50 up front as a deposit. If you lasted your 90 days, in addition to your regular every two-week paycheck, they'd give you that $50 back and a $50 bonus, which A couple of years later, was determined not to be a legal practice. You were basically paying for your employment the way the courts decided. But at the time, I borrowed $50 from my dad and signed up for it.
I was going to say $50 for a college student. It was quite steep back then. Even now, I guess.
You're right. I mean, $50. Who had $50 in 1977 when you look at the cost of everything else back then?
Now, the novel itself, it opens up. It says it's May of 1977. A 19-year-old Angelo Schuster has just boarded a bus for Northern Arizona. And right from the beginning of the bus, we get some action because some guy is riding his bike as fast as he can alongside the bus. And so Angelo yells out, "Hey, that guy's trying to get on." And so then begins a long friendship with Frosty and Angelo.
Yeah, Frosty was the older guy. Frosty was a short man, and he was an Army veteran himself. But he was an old man compared to Angelo, who's 19. Frosty was 24 years old, and he was out there going to school on the GI Bill, but he saw that same classified ad that Angelo had, and he jumped on the bus, and they were instant friends. So it was a good connection to Las Cruces for Angelo to have as he worked throughout the summer.
Angelo and Frosty really didn't have any idea what they had gotten themselves into, as did any of the other students, correct?
You're right. It was a real mixture of characters and a real mixture of jobs. Just about any job you can think of when you're at a remote resort hotel, because basically it's a standalone town. You have to have everything from a medical clinic to a food service and garbage removal and room cleaning, and who's going to carry all those suitcases, plus all the maintenance jobs and engineering jobs and plumbers and electricians. So they met this kind of circus when they got there, and it's a lot to take in, but it's all set in this beautiful yet fictitious environment. It's a mountain resort, and it's 8,000 feet up, or it's a higher elevation, ponderosa pines and aspen trees, and just a beautiful place to work for 90 days.
And this place is Aspen Bark Resort in Northern Arizona. And as you, it says in the back of the book that over the next 90 days, Angelo will work there, and he thinks he's going to get a break from school, but he gets a different kind of education. He gets a crash course in everything from cleaning rooms to meteor showers, CB radios, floor waxing, relationships, nonstop journey continues, and he meets a lot of interesting characters.
He does, and that's where that title comes from. You know, it's kind of like summer camp for young adults. Your parents aren't sending you there, but, you know, when you're there, you're learning all kinds of new stuff. You're making new friends. You're living in all the natural beauty. You do some hiking on your days off. And so it's kind of like an extended summer camp for these young people. And it's just it's a lot of fun, but there's a lot of stress mixed in with all the new things you've got to learn quickly.
The book takes place in the summer of 1977, and that's, I guess, when you were working at the Grand Canyon. So my question is, you must have taken quite a bit of notes, or, as you mentioned, after you got out of the Army, started thinking about that, because this book is very detailed.
Well, it's part of it is just having vivid memories of it. I remember, even in the Army, you know, you get some free time and you're sitting around with friends and fellow soldiers, and people start talking about anything and everything. And among topics is, what's the worst job you ever had and what's the best job you ever had? You know, people instantly point to the Army as their worst job, but that's not always the case. You know, some guys before the Army may have been scrubbing toilets for a living, and Angelo in the book gets a taste of that. And so I did just, I felt kind of like a tape recorder when I was there that first summer at the Grand Canyon. I met so many characters and just real contrasting personalities. And there were some very, very funny incidents that happened that first summer that I just felt like I had to write these things down and alter them, you know, change names and change location and things. I don't want to embarrass anybody by this stuff, but these people are real. Even though they're in a fiction book, there's one guy, for example, Jack, who is his partner in the Porter van. They ride around in a van, and if somebody's a late checkout at one of the lodge rooms, they have to go change that the bed sheets there and towels and clean the tub and sinks and everything in that room and get it ready for a quick check-in by a late check-in guest. And Jack is just he's his own person. He's a surfer boy from California, and he has his own way of doing things, but he turns out to be a pretty good friend for Angelo, even though their personalities are not at all alike.
What also takes you back to 1977 is you have always been one for dates and memories, songs. You would always refer to a season as summer of 77, fall of 76, whatever. But in the book, when the employees go to have a drink or go to the cafeteria, there's this jukebox, and somebody also has a turntable. And you mentioned these names of these songs and different artists. And one of the people we used to work with back at New Mexico State, she mentioned how it was like a time capsule taking you back just by mentioning the song.
Oh, you know, Louis, that's something that has always just triggered my memories, is to hear a song. The other day I was listening to the radio here in Albuquerque, and Still the One by Orleans came on the radio, and I was taken back to September of 76. As soon as I heard that, I was thinking about, what was I doing back then? Well, I was a little freshman at NMSU and trying to figure out my class schedule, but it was just, it's always so great the way songs can bring back a flood of memories and faces and names and events.
How long did it take you to write this book? Because this is a pretty thick book. It's almost 800 pages.
Well, this book was one of those projects where I would get going on it and I'd get distracted. And then, you know, I really did not kick things into gear until the pandemic, when I was not out and about doing other things and mingling with other people. I was kind of self-quarantined here at the house. And so I think I started this book probably 4 or 5 years ago, as far as gathering initial notes. And those are things like writing down specific events from that first summer at Grand Canyon, and how could I incorporate that event or character into the book. And then I started writing down individual characters, people who I knew, and some of these are characters based on people that, Louis, you and I worked with, because they had such strong personalities and maybe some little quirks, something about them that set them off from everybody else. So I would make a list of characters and start trying to assign names to them that would work, that were fitting to the person. And so, but it wasn't until probably a year ago that I just put it on fast burn and started hammering out copy, and then would go back through it and rewrite over and over.
We're visiting with Bill Armstrong. Bill is the author of the recent book, Uncle Ludie's Summer Camp, Making Beds and Bread in the Summer of 77. How did you come about, as you mentioned, there were characters based on people that you work with and people that you and I worked with here in El Paso. What about the names and selecting the different people, different jobs, etc.?
Well, you know, for example, I was trying to come up with a name for that national monument, that fictitious place where Aspen Bark Resort sits, and I came up with Ludwig Boyer because I started going through different nationalities of different American immigrants, and I found Swiss immigrants with the first name of Ludwig, and then I tried to match it with a Swiss name that maybe wasn't every day. And then I would Google those names and try to make sure they did not match any significant or famous person so that people didn't think I was writing about them. Fortunately for me, Ludi turned out to be a nickname for Ludwig, and so that's one. But some of the other people, it was just random searches through long lists of male and female names, and in some cases they were first names of people that I knew back then but had no tie to the character I was giving that name to.
How did Frosty get his name?
Well, when Frosty was a kid, he loved the story of Frosty the Snowman. He loved singing it, and so it kind of took when he was a little guy, just barely talking. And there are some of these details that probably should have been put in the book. You know, if I had done that, there were a handful of things that I ended up not putting in the book when I started realizing how big this thing was becoming.
But you did an excellent job of adding different things in the book about the different characters and different stories, because I think by the time the reader finishes the book, he or she is pretty much well familiar with Frosty, with Angelo, with Holly, with Jack, I forgot your boss's name, the weirdo guy.
Paul Devereaux.
Paul Devereaux, yeah. He was something else because, and then one of the things that stands out too is, Angelo's upbringing, because he is being brought up a certain way, and you can tell people come from different families, and the fact that Angelo is struggling too as to, is he going to continue his education? Is he going to stay there? What are his parents going to think? And what are other people going to think? But at the very end, because of everything that he's been through, it's almost like a basic training camp for young people.
You're so right, Louis. I think Angelo comes from the kind of family who they pay a lot of attention to him. They want him to grow up to be a good adult. But at the same time, he's a human being, and he's got curiosity. He's around other guys who have done things that he just either wasn't interested in or may have been a little timid about, or maybe it just, you know, it crossed a moral boundary for him. But as Frosty tries to point out, and a couple other people try to point out, that Angelo, because of his youthfulness, is a bit judgmental, and he doesn't intentionally do it, but he projects his personal rules onto people like Holly. And, you know, maybe there's some underlying resentment there because of that.
And Angelo, in addition to learning how to make beds, learning how to work in different parts of the park, he also, as you mentioned, in between shifts, they get to go on hikes. And it turns out that he learns a lot about astronomy, but also about birds and bird watching, and kind of some interesting scenes there, because some of the times when they're walking back, and like when that rock throwing person is there, and then also when they hear that there's a mama cat, mountain lion up on the roar, and so they have to be careful about all that.
Yeah, and then that is also a reflection of living on the South Rim at the Grand Canyon for a while. It's like living in a wild animal preserve. You have to be aware that this was their home before human beings ever set foot there. So, you know, the rattlesnake that's underneath the boulder, it's his right to be there. So you want to kind of give him a wide berth and walk around it. Don't get too curious. Don't get too close. And when you do see, when you're on the trail and you see a mountain lion, a puma, you want to, when you get back, report it to the rangers so they can kind of keep track of where the big cats are and maybe go check it out themselves in case sometimes you run into rabid animals, and so they get pretty aggressive. They can attack people. And this is a new experience for Angelo. He's never been around mountain lions before.
One of the things that came to mind was some of the things we had in college when they would have lunch at Preciado Park, dinner at Preciado Park, is at the very end when everybody's getting ready to say goodbye and you all are out there having a cookout, and then the news comes out that Elvis Presley has died. And, well, I'll let you finish that.
You know, that is an incident directly connected to my summer, my first summer at the canyon. I remember being in the employee cafeteria when someone announced that Elvis Presley had passed away, and someone actually shouted out, thinking he was, you know, being funny, who cares? And I thought at the time it was so cold-blooded to say something like that, so disrespectful. You may not have been a fan of the man, but, you know, what did he ever do to you? Why do you have to say that as soon as you hear that he's passed away? So I felt like that really said the end of summer of 77 was when Elvis passed away, and so I had to put that in the book. I had to have someone like Frosty, who was a little older and had seen a lot of Elvis movies and had enjoyed his music. You know, he had to make some kind of a counter comment about that.
And we don't want to tell people how this ends, but it has a different ending. But if people want to get this book, how do they go about going and purchasing this book?
Just go on to Amazon and under books, go to Uncle Ludi's Summer Camp. It's a paperback, and it's also an e-book, a Kindle book. And I hope they like it. As you said, it's a very lengthy book, but I hope you enjoy it, and I hope it puts you in a time machine and takes you back to different times, sometimes really fun times, interesting times.
Bill, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Louie.
We've been visiting with Bill Armstrong. He is the author of the book, Uncle Ludi's Summer Camp, Making Beds and Bread in the Summer of 77. The book club is taped and produced at the KTAP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Sam Cassiano. You've been tuned to the book club. I'm Louie Sines.